Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
And I get nothing but bad press from the dishonest media. It is absolutely disgraceful.
Don Henley getting us started on a Reporters Roundtable edition of Route 51. I'm Glenn Moberg. Donald Trump is now the 45th president of the United States, and the last couple of weeks have been eventful. From the firing of the acting attorney general to the Supreme Court pick, to the inauguration speech, to the travel ban, to millions of people demonstrating against the new president and women's marches around the world, and the vice president addressing a crowd of pro-life demonstrators in Washington. All of this happening during an ongoing war of words with the media. Well, we've got a great mix of regional reporters to hash it out here in the studio. Nora Hertel, public issues investigator for USA Today Network Wisconsin and the Wausau Daily Herald. And Mark McPherson, news anchor for WAOW-TV9 in Wausau. On the phone, Paul DeMaine, CEO and managing editor of Indian Country Communications. And we'll also hear from Brian Jopek of the Lakeland Times. In this age of fake news and questions about the media, we'll also talk with our guests about their philosophy. How do you know something is the truth, and when do you call a lie a lie? We've got a lot to talk about today. We'd like to hear from you. If you've got a question for our guests, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Well, thank you all for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
And thank you.
It has been a remarkable couple of weeks with the new administration. Let's get right into it. America remains polarized. The divisions aren't being smoothed over at this moment. I'd like each of you to give me your reflections on the millions of people who turned out for those marches around the world, the protests at the airports, and now we've got a revolt of some federal employees, and also the reaction of Trump supporters who say the protesters should realize that they lost the election and they should give the new president a chance. Nora, let's start with you.
Well, I kind of think it's just the beginning of protests. I've been following some essays and commentary about that, and I think that they're just getting started. Whether they'll be able to make long-term change, really, I think, depends on if they can set and agree upon a platform. There's a lot of different groups, a lot of different interests represented at those marches.
Mark McPherson?
Reminds me a lot of the anger after President Obama was elected and those protests, which turned into the Tea Party. So one side saying, you know, you lost, get over it, doesn't seem very genuine because the same thing happened 8 years ago and even 4 years ago. The question will be, and what Nora brought up, is whether it can lead to long-term substantive change. There's a lot of people that are unhappy right now, but we saw in New York there were protests for a long time down there on Wall Street, and those didn't really turn into anything. So the big question is whether this will be long-term.
Those Occupy Wall Street protests. Mm-hmm. Paul DeMaine, your take on the protesters, do you think it's going to be short or long-lived, and what do you think is motivating them?
I tend to agree with Nora that we may be at the front end of a lot of these kinds of activities, because not only – it's not about just losing an election. It's really being about being anxious about the kind of actions and how those actions are taking place by a president. It's not that there needs to be reforms in a time that's given to him and an opportunity to initiate change. In part, it's the perception of how it's being done, how it's being jammed down the throats, the tone of negotiations. So I think we're just really at the front end of a lot of this. And I hope that rather than just the demonstrations, that people get out and look at how to organize and functionally impact policy.
Now, here are my own thoughts, and this is based on talking to some demonstrators and what I've also seen on Facebook posts. I don't think there would be this kind of opposition to Mr. Trump if Hillary Clinton hadn't gotten 2,800,000 more votes than him in the general election. To the protesters, he shouldn't have won. and he doesn't have a mandate. And you can argue with them all you want about the Electoral College and tell them, well, that's not right. That's not how we choose presidents in this country. But they come back and say 2.8 million more people in this country want to keep the Affordable Care Act. They want to keep abortion illegal. They don't want the immigration ban. They don't want the wall built. They don't want a conservative on the Supreme Court. They don't want a rollback of environmental regulations. So to me, you can argue all you want that the Constitution and the Electoral College put Mr. Trump in the White House. And, you know, he is certainly a legitimate president because of that. But that's not how the protesters see it. And that same Constitution gives them First Amendment rights of speech, free speech, and the right to assemble and redress grievances. And I think they're going to use it. And I would agree with Nora that I don't think it's going to go away real quickly. Paul, what's your reaction to what I just said?
Well, and again, I don't think it's just people being angry or upset about how the Electoral College process works. I think it has to do with all these components you talked about. When you poll people on a lot of these things, you find that the policies that people are supporting seem to be at difference in collectively. I think a lot of people who voted for Trump saw him as an agent of huge change, and the anxiety is about how that change is taking place. I don't think, you know, going back to my years in the governor's office, when there was a time when we drafted legislation with people from both political parties involved in it, seems to be gone. And now we seem to be driven by a tit for a tat. People want vengeance for what's happened. And there is anger there, but I don't see people demonstrating just because Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. I see them because the kinds of policy things now that are taking place are issues that people disagree with and how it was done. Just take that the immigration ban. There needs to be reforms on immigration, but how it was done, one day they're calling it a Muslim ban, the next day they're saying it's not a Muslim ban, and the third day they're blaming it on Obama. There needs to be a tone set here by the president that eases the Trump administration into the country rather than this day-by-day situation where every morning you wake up and the attorney general's gone, or all the gag order on the press capabilities, Department of Interior can't talk with tribes now without going through the White House. Those kinds of things, I think, are leading to the very high unpopularity trends in his polling.
Mark?
And I think Paul touched on it there. It isn't just some of the things he's doing, it's how he's doing it. He's not a normal candidate. A lot of things are coming through Twitter. A lot of things seem to come out without vetting them through any departments, seem to come off the top of his head and then turn into policy. And I think that's what makes people the most nervous and is motivating people right now.
Nora?
I'm not sure where to go from there. I agree that the format is disconcerting to people. I mean, the way that we're learning from it, the tone. But I disagree with Paul a little. I don't know that we can expect a tone change at this point. This was the tone of the campaign, and this has been the tone for the last 5 days. Like, he's coming in for change, and I don't think that we can expect that to continue.
Well, let's move to foreign affairs. A lot of breaking news. We had a military raid in Yemen that killed a number of civilians, including 10 women and children. It also killed U.S. Navy SEAL William Ryan Owens. According to Reuters, U.S. military officials approved the raid without sufficient intelligence, ground support, or adequate backup preparations, but Reuters didn't give any source for that comment. And then General Michael Flynn says Iran has been put on notice after a missile test. What does that mean, Mark McPherson, to be put on notice?
That worries some people, I think, too. When you're talking about nuclear war, you need to choose your words carefully. But that statement mirrored the things that President Trump was saying in his inauguration speech. It reminded you of the Reagan eras of, we are number one, and we're going to be, and we're going to put ourselves first, and we're going to lead through strength. And I think that's what the administration is trying to do. They're not going to see a missile test by Iran and then try to be diplomatic about the you know, that talk afterwards. They want to show strength and say, you know, you're not going to do things because we're the strongest country and we're putting ourselves number one.
And also, we had some leaks about a couple of telephone exchanges that the president had with the president of Mexico and also Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, in which he attacked the president a plan to resettle refugees in America that's been in the works for a while. Mr. Trump later tweeted it was thousands of illegal immigrants who'd be coming here. It was actually refugees. Trump called it a dumb deal, and the prime minister, he said, was sending the next Boston bombers to the U.S. And then we also have unsubstantiated reports that he threatened to bring troops across the border in Mexico. And once again, we're hearing the leaks about these telephone calls from people in the administration. They're being published, but we don't have any sources to back them up, nor does that concern you as a journalist.
Definitely. I mean, the thing about having a kind of hostile administration is that reporters in D.C. and following them are going to have to look for alternative ways of getting information. They're going to have to use anonymous sources and that kind of thing. I think they should. I think that we should be trying to get as much information as we can, but they're going to have to publish it with a grain of salt, and readers are going to have to consider it with a grain of salt.
And not using sources is something that's been done a lot in this country. Would we have had the information we had about Watergate if we hadn't had a source like Deep Throat, who was never identified by Woodward and Bernstein?
Yeah, and that goes to the media. People need to trust the media, because a media source can come out and say, I can't tell you who this is, but trust me, it's a solid source. So the people reading the publication need to feel confident about that publication to know, okay, if you say that they're solid, I can believe that.
Christy on Facebook writes, I am deeply concerned about the role of media in our society. We need a good, strong, independent media to keep those in power in check. What I feel is happening is a discrediting of the news media. I've heard lots of things that the media should do to rebuild the trust that seems to have been lost. What does your panel think should be done? News should not be equated with entertainment, which also seems to be the norm. There are outlets that are good, but it's hard to find them. Paul DeMaine, your reaction to what I just read.
Well, there's indeed a lot of entertainment news nowadays and alternative facts and materials going out. The media needs to really work at vetting its information all the time. When you're talking about confidential sources, those are essential, but they ought to be utilized rare. I can understand why we're beginning to see information now coming out of the Trump administration and edges of it as people are leaking this stuff, because people will be fired very quickly if they're found to be leaking. But the media needs to continue to work in terms of sourcing its information. They need to make sure that if there's errors in the sourcing of that information, that they get right in front of it and admit that they've made a mistake in regards to the information and correct it as fast as possible. But media is kind of on the line right now, because people have focused their attention to it, pointed fingers and saying, you, the guys, are the ones that are creating fake news. We need to be able to get back to those ethics of sourcing our information again and again so that people can trust us.
Now, the travel ban from seven predominantly Muslim countries has provoked demonstrations at airports around the country. We had rulings striking down key provisions by federal judges, a refusal to support the policy by acting Attorney General Sally Yates, who was fired, and now, of course, a rush to confirm Jeff Sessions as Attorney General because of the vacancy. I want to play a perspective of another reporter on the travel ban. Brian Jopek is the news director for the Lakeland Times in Minocqua. He served in Iraq, and he lost his son Ryan in combat there. He says the travel ban and some of the president's comments could hurt the efforts of our troops who are still in that country. And he particularly mentioned Muslim interpreters whose lives are at risk for helping the American cause and who are now affected by the ban.
I was in a public affairs unit, and there were people out there that knew that these interpreters worked with us. And by the time my unit came home, there were at least three of those interpreters who were killed by insurgents. One of them, some of the guys in my unit, and I got pretty close to. His name was Samir. I guess that kind of helped formulate the way I look at things, they aren't all bad people. Joe Blow Iraqi gets up every day like you and I do. Get up, get ready for work, read the paper, watch some news, and then go to work. Just wants to live his life.
Some claim that the president's order would make it harder for people to volunteer to be interpreters and work with us on our side because we've essentially told these folks in the past that we'll have your back if anything goes wrong. Right. Do you lend any credence to that argument?
I could see where that would play a factor. Guys like Samir, who we work with, he was committed to getting his country back. And I can see where this sort of policy, if it continues, could hurt efforts of some of our people on the ground over there to get some of those locals, if you want to call them that, to help them out.
The president also said in his first network interview after being elected and taking office that torture works. How will that statement affect our troops, potentially?
I think his new Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, a lot of people like to call him Mad Dog and everything. I think a lot of people have him read incorrectly. He's very well read on things in the Mideast. He's got a lot of stick time over there. He's got a lot of an understanding of the different tradition that torture doesn't work, that beer and cigarettes works. Mattis has found over time to get information much more so than something like waterboarding. My personal opinion is if they go ahead and they would happen to reintroduce a torture program or introduce a torture program, what have you, I think it could have some pretty dire effect in the long run on any U.S. troops or allied troops, coalition troops in that area over time. Because if there's one thing I think we've all seen, groups like ISIS, they're all about revenge, retribution, what have you, and they'll use that sort of thing to their advantage in their own propaganda, their own attacks.
That's Brian Jopek, news director and reporter for the Lakeland Times in Minocqua. He served in Iraq, and he lost his son Ryan in combat there. Paul DeMaine, your reaction to what you just heard?
Well, I think he's correct in it. This whole immigration vetting and ban and everything was pushed as a Muslim ban, which I think is unfortunate because we're talking about trying to increase in the vetting and security of the United States. It's not done by issuing an order without having consulted with numerous people, from my understanding. But, you know, you want to look at it kind of from a point of view of a Native American person of multicultural descent. There are times in this country when there should have been vetting that started back all the way in 1492 from our perspective. But now that we have to live in this country, I think we need to understand that the country needs to be as open as it can be to refugees, and then specifically to our allies, whether they're Hmong or Iraqis or Afghanis who have assisted with this. Those people ought to have a route to be protected and get to the United States if they need to be, without being shut out simply because they happen to be a Muslim versus a Christian or some other ethnicity. So it needs to be vetted and fixed in a much more general way than to be specifically targeting religious groups or ethnic groups.
Nora Hurdle, the move to ban refugees, particularly from Syria, that flies in the face of the mission of some religious people, the Lutherans in this town, in Wausau, settled Hmong refugees many, many years ago.
Right, and I've seen postings by Methodists about being open to refugees, and the Pope made a statement as well. You know, I don't have a strong opinion about this, or I'm not going to share it, but I think that there's a lot that we can do locally on this issue. We can help provide historical perspective, and we can talk to the people in the area who might be affected by this or who might have family members who are affected by this. I think we should be doing that.
A number of celebrities are voicing opposition to the travel ban, and that's, of course, to be expected. Celebrities are weighing in on everything, but one in particular is raising some eyebrows, Dale Earnhardt Jr., the most popular NASCAR driver in the world and a favorite with many Trump supporters, has come out against the immigration ban, Mark McPherson.
Will he still be a favorite among Trump supporters after he came out against the immigration ban will be the question. I think three things that hurt this immigration ban were the rollout, I think, wasn't done well. I think there was a lot of miscommunication. A lot of people got angry about it before they knew what it was. I think because it didn't cover any countries that attacks, including and since 9/11, none of the attackers are from any of these countries, I think hurt this ban. And I think Brian brought it up, it's being used as a recruitment tool. You know, if ISIS is going around saying there is a war against Islam and a war against Muslims by the United States, this kind of a ban doesn't help anything, especially the way it was rolled out.
What would it do to America's moral standing in the world and our appeal to Muslims to help us in the war on terror if the commander-in-chief indeed pushed the use of torture, which is something that he says works?
That's what surprised me most about his answer was, in the past, under the Bush administration, they've used the term enhanced interrogation techniques. We don't torture. We use enhanced interrogation.
Well, Mr. Trump is very plain spoken.
Yeah, that's what surprised me. For him to come out and say, I think torture works and I like it and I think we should use it, but our generals say no, I think that's what surprised me the most.
Well, I think it was surprising also, though, he said it several times, you know, this is the way I think this works, but – you know, my general doesn't, and I'm going to defer to him, which is kind of an unusual phrasing as well. I mean, I guess he's nothing if not interesting in his speech.
Yeah. Paul DeMaine, you broadcast and you write for a tribal audience. How are they reacting to the Trump administration? A number of Hispanics in this country are openly supporting Donald Trump, which surprised a lot of people. Do we have Native American people who are supporting Mr. Trump?
Oh, absolutely. We have people who are in all political views and associations. And so I think, like with any administration, Indian country pragmatically will look at how they can make lemonade out of lemons, even if there's some lemon lies in the whole batch as well. And that is that I don't think Indian country has figured out what it is that the next agenda is going to be. But whether or not it's in cutbacks on programs or the relationship, for example, right now there's this order by the White House for the Department of Interior and Bureau of Indian Affairs officials. They cannot consult directly with tribal governments. It's just like says it's not going to happen. It's got to go through the White House. So there's all this micromanagement going on. Indian tribes will be looking at what this administration offers, because some conservative, for example, conservative justice, it was a 7th District conservative court that overturned a liberal judge, Judge Crabb, on the treaty rights issues. There are conservatives that have worked with Indian tribes in the past with good policy. So, for example, the Nixon administration brought out the Indian Reorganization Act and several other fundamental laws that Indian country looked at. Indian country is used to these flip-flops over the time in terms of policy, so I think we're just going to hold our breath a little bit and sit back and see where the ride goes.
You mentioned the federal courts. Do you think Neil Gorsuch should be approved as the next Supreme Court justice?
Personally, I don't, but conservative judges also understand contract and treaty law in a way that a lot of liberal judges have not understood the context of it. You know, with time, things change. No, a contract is a contract is a contract, and that's been what has upheld a lot of the rights of Indian nations and the tribes in the United States. So personally, I don't think a conservative judge like this individual intellect who kind of carves out his rulings with people say he's really prolific with the words and everything, but what he's done is carve out a conservative policy. He appears to be a right-wing activist judge rather than a liberal activist judge.
Very quickly, I want Mark and Nora to weigh in on the Supreme Court justice. Do you think he's going to be approved? Do you think there'll be a filibuster? If there is a filibuster, do you think Mitch McConnell is going to do something he doesn't want to do and eliminate the filibuster as part of the institution of the United States Senate? Mark?
I think he'll be approved. I don't think there'll be a filibuster. I was reading recently that Democrats – you know, they're replacing Antonin Scalia, a conservative, with another conservative. There's a chance that a liberal may leave the court or pass away this year. Democrats want to hold that ammo in their rifle until that happens. They don't want the filibuster to be taken away now and then a liberal judge leave the court and have no way to stop a Republican from filling it with a conservative.
Nora, what's your gut feeling on this?
I mean, I think that they've got a lot of momentum, and I think that so far the Republicans have been able to appoint who they wanted to appoint.
You're listening to a Reporter's Roundtable on Route 51 with Paul DeMaine, CEO and Managing Editor of Indian Country Communications, Nora Hurdle, Public Issues Investigator with USA Today Wisconsin and the Wausau Daily Herald. Also, Mark McPherson, news anchor at WAOW-TV9. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a phone call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it live on the air. We're going to take a short break. Here's Bob Dylan.
I'm senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. For the battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are changing.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Ester News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-Law.com.
The old man turned off the radio, said, where did all of the old songs go? Kids sure play funny music these days, they play it in the strangest way. Said, it looks to me like they've all gone wild. It was peaceful back when I was a child. Well, man, could it be that the girls and boys are trying to be heard above your noise? And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth?
Johnny Cash asking the question we'll be asking in this segment, what is truth? With our guests on the Route 51 Reporters Roundtable, Paul DeMaine of Indian Country Communications, Nora Hurdle of the Wausau Daily Herald, and Mark McPherson of WAOW-TV9. I'm Glenn Moberg. To say that there is tension between the incoming Trump administration and the media is an understatement. Steve Bannon, one of his closest advisors, says the media is the opposition party and reporters should shut up and listen. And Reuters, which is an international news organization, is now telling its correspondents in the U.S. to cover the administration like an authoritarian regime. Expect physical threats if you're on the beat. Does that seem a little bit overblown to you, Mark McPherson?
Yes. I'm going Facebook Live. It's the new era of news. We have to do Facebook Live here. But I think I can understand why the Trump administration feels like the media is attacking them. I'm not saying I think it's right that they do, but I can understand they do. I don't think we've ever heard from a presidential administration that the media shouldn't be in the building, that they need to shut up. Steve Bannon says that he thinks Sean Spicer is being too easy on the media in some of these press releases or some of these press conferences they have. So I think we're in a dangerous new era when it comes to trashing the media.
Well, let's listen to three clips. We'll hear candidate Donald Trump at a campaign event last year. We'll hear him at a news conference in a confrontation with a CNN reporter, and then an exchange between counselor to the president Kellyanne Conway and Chuck Todd on Meet the Press.
We are in a rigged system, and a big part of the rigging are these dishonest people in the media. Big part. Isn't it amazing how, you know, they don't even want to look at you, folks. I think they consider you, like Hillary, they consider you deplorable and irredeemable also.
I think it's a disgrace. And I say that. And that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do. I think it's a disgrace. That information that was false and fake and never happened got released to the public. As far as BuzzFeed, which is a failing pile of garbage, writing it, I think they're going to suffer the consequences. They already are. And as far as CNN going out of their way to build it up, it's a disgrace what took place. It's a disgrace. And I think they ought to apologize to start with Michael Cohen.
Since you're attacking us, can you give us a question? Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead.
Mr. President-elect, since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance?
Your organization.
You are attacking our news organization.
Your organization.
Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir,
You did not answer the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered.
Hey, Chuck,
was Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
Can there be alternative facts, or are alternative facts falsehoods? Let's start with you, Paul DeMaine. A lot of people who you write and broadcast for view the world differently than the predominant Anglo culture in America.
Certainly do. I mean, there's the old tale about all the blind men that are hanging on to different parts of the elephant, and each one of the descriptions of the elephant is true. But I think at this particular point, what we have is a president and a press corps administration that is inciting and demonizing the press for their own personal reasons. And so when they go out there and lie to the public, which they have, they expect the media to stand in line and report exactly what they have to say. I think it's our job to make sure that those facts are vetted. And I'll correct myself, because I said Nixon and the Indian Reorganization Act, and I was wrong. The minute I said that, I realized I had to go look it up. It was actually the Self-Determination Act that was put into place versus termination under the Nixon administration. So we've got to be ready to correct ourselves and correct what we're saying, but we need to make sure those facts, and we are the people who hold our political officials accountable for what they say based on facts that we can vet.
Nora Hurdle, when you write a story for the Wausau Daily Herald, you get something wrong, could you go to your publisher and say, well, I was just giving you an alternative fact?
Definitely not. I have to fact check all my stories. And when I get a call and someone thinks that I misinterpreted something or the headline is misleading, something like that, we talk about it. Sometimes we make a change. Sometimes we don't, if we think that they're speaking out of their own personal interest. But if something's wrong, we put a note at the top and we correct it. And I would like to comment on Bannon's statement about the media needs to listen and stop talking. I do think that we need to listen. I think that we're having kind of a crisis in terms of an identity crisis for the media. And I think that we do need to listen to our communities in terms of should we shut up? Definitely not.
I've often said as a reporter that it's easy to talk. We have a lot of people who are good talkers in my line of work. But listening is what provides me usually with my best stories. If I go to a scene and something is there that isn't the way I thought it would be, that's usually what you have to follow up on, because that's where the real story is. Mm-hmm. Mark McPherson, real facts versus alternative facts.
I'm one of the few people, I think, that's trying to give Kellyanne Conway the benefit of the doubt on the. I think what she might have been referring to is they came out later and said that if you include the audience for the internet audience, it was the most watched inauguration ever. So I think what she maybe meant was there were some facts that were left out of what was talked about. They were alternative to what you were saying. Maybe I'm going too far in trying to bail her out, but I think
you would call that context, and you could cry. You could say they left out some context, but alternative facts is a questionable term.
Yeah, it is, and there was a ramp up to it. You know, it was emotional, so I'm sure she regretted saying it. But however, I'm not defending the Trump administration. The fact that they have been attacking the media in a vicious way since the start of the campaign. Encouraging crowds to get angry at the media, and people do that so that they can discredit the media and then do whatever they want. So I think it's – I think I agree with Nora that this is not a time for us to shut up. It's a time for us to be louder, I think.
Now, President Trump has repeatedly claimed that there were 3 to 5 million fraudulent votes cast in the election without any evidence. The New York Times used a phrase that we don't often use as journalists. They said in a headline that he was repeating a lie. NPR editors, on the other hand, simply called it a falsehood. At public radio, we don't usually use the word lie because that implies intent, which you can't easily discern. So let's talk about this for a while. As a general principle, when a statement is false and the person saying it has been shown repeatedly that it's false and the person keeps saying it anyway, at what point can you call a lie? Or maybe because you have to discern intent, you can never use that phrase. What are your standards? I want to start with you, Paul.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting perspective, you know, like at what point does a false fact become an intentional lie? I've had to deal with that in regards to several investigations into some murders that took place in the 1970s, where people who truly believed that certain things had occurred were a factual perspective of what had happened. It was a falsehood. Was it a lie? It may not have been. But again, the perspective was is that their perspective was right. So if the administration is simply going out there and saying things without all the facts, they're doing it in air and unintentionally. But I think that we're beginning to see things here that are simply alternative facts that they want to put out there without vetting the information. The correct information is out there, and it becomes at least an edge of an intentional lie.
Mark McPherson?
Yeah, and I think that's along the lines, because I think it is a fact that, and I haven't looked at these numbers, that there's probably 3 million people that are registered in 2 different states. Combine that with people who have passed away that are still registered.
Many of them on Trump's staff or his relatives.
Several of them, yeah.
That doesn't mean that you're casting a fraudulent vote.
Exactly, yeah. So it's taking something that might be true and blowing it up to something that is now flat out not true. Now, if you investigate and there is fraud, he can come back and say, see, I was right. But right now he doesn't know and he's still pushing a fact. So you have to wait. You have to get to a point where you know they're intentionally lying to call them a liar. But this is very, very close.
Nora, the New York Times is using the word lie. What about the Wausau Daily Herald?
I would not be comfortable using the word liar. It's definitely something I'd have to run back past our editorial staff. I would refer to organizations and analyses like PolitiFact that look at specific statements and give the context and say, you know, rate statements as true, mostly true, false, and sometimes pants on fire. And I think you can put in a story, we know, or here's what the data says, and yet the administration continues to say X, Y, or Z, which has been debunked several times. I think that we just need to keep giving context.
Which leads us to a bigger question. How do we know what the truth is? Philosophers call it epistemology, the theory of knowledge. What are your standards for determining that something is factually true and worthy of being written or broadcast? Paul DeMaine?
Oh, geez, that's an easy one. You know, it's got to do with working with your sources of information, looking at the documents, vetting the individual that's speaking to you, fact-checking, double-checking, not being in haste in this world of age of Facebook and facts where people post things immediately. There's horrible things that are up there. They're not associated with the media at all, but I think the media is being blamed for some of the fact that there's just so much information out there and it's unvetted. And there is no quality to it. You want to find out about American Indians, you can become an American Indian by going online and studying them, but there's all kinds of material out there that is not factually based at all. The search for the truth, I think, is through perspective. Everybody's story is important. Everyone has their perspective about what the story, but there are only certain things that can be factual within the context, okay? We all touch the elephant. We all agreed that we were touching in different perspectives and saw and felt different things, but we all agree that there is an elephant there. Let's put that down as a fact and get by it. And let's explore why there are differences from the other sources of information.
Nora, how do you know what the truth is?
I have a clarification. I think that truth and facts are different. I think that truth is very slippery, and I think that facts are much easier to pin down. I try to focus on facts myself. I can't remember who said this, if this is a proverb or what, but every person has their own truth. You know, you want to know what happened at an event. You talk to one person and another, and what actually happened is probably something in the middle. That is what we try to do as journalists, is we try to find what really happened, what is really at the bottom of it. But, we're only as good as how many perspectives we get, as Paul said.
Mark?
I think the truth is what you can prove. If you can prove it, or not the truth, sorry, facts are what you can prove. You know, if you can prove it, then it's a fact. And if not, then, you can't come out and say this is an absolute verifiable fact.
I agree. My standard as a reporter is empirical evidence, hopefully by more than one observer. It's a standard that's used in the courtroom. You prove somebody is guilty of murder if you've got eyewitness accounts or if you gathered enough evidence at the scene. It's also the standard of the laboratory, where we come up with theories and the truth based on multiple observations from trained observers over and over again. So to me, something is true if it's supported by science. If it's not, if it's something that is simply held as faith by someone, it might be true, it might not. But empirical evidence is what I use as my standard.
Yeah, the problem is eyewitness testimony, and you touched on this a little bit, it comes from the perspective of the person who saw it. Two people can be at the same President Trump rally and see and feel two different things and have two different truths about it.
We asked News Director Brian Jopek of the Lakeland Times the same question: how do you know something is true? He says you should be able to publish a named source for anything that you print.
I'm not a big fan of sources say or unnamed source. I'm not a big fan of that sort of reporting. When I do a story, that's pretty much been the policy here. We try to get the source name. Who said that? And can you back it up that he actually did say that or she said that? Those are some of the standards that I try to follow and that I expect the reporters here at the newspaper. I know my publisher does as well. And I can see where it would be difficult for people in this day and age of all these different websites and all sorts of digital media with everything coming at you, when some guy can be a news editor from the comfort of his living room with his laptop and can make up whatever he wants to and then suddenly gets an audience. I can see where that might get to confuse people over time. It does put a little more pressure on the media as a whole to take steps to make sure that what we're putting out there is a fact, not an alternative fact, but a fact. I mean, this is what we're reporting on. This is what he said, or this is what she said.
That's Brian Jopek of the Lakeland Times, and I think we're just going to have to hold it at that. We're way behind time. I've got to take a break. You're listening to a Reporter's Roundtable with Paul DeMain, CEO and Managing Editor of Indian Country Communications, Nora Hurdle of the USA Today Wisconsin Network and the Wausau Daily Herald, and Mark McPherson of WAOW-TV9. We're going to take a short break. Here's Hedgehoppers Anonymous.
It's Good News Week. Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky. It's Good News Week. Someone's found a way to give the rotting dead a will to live, go on and never die. Have you heard the news? What did it say? Who's won that race? What's the weather like today? It's Good News Week.
Support for WPR comes from Glass Nickel Pizza. 19 years of employee and customer-inspired pizzas made from scratch at 8 Wisconsin locations. Dedicated to sustainability practices and community support. GlassNickelPizza.com. Support also comes from FarmShed of Stevens Point and their local food buying club, enabling the bulk purchase of produce from local farmers with an option to process and preserve the items in the FarmShed kitchen. More information is at farmshed.org.
If you want to know about the gay politician,
yeah.
If you want to know how to drive your car, if you want to know about the new sex position,
We're back with our Reporters Roundtable with Paul DeMaine of Indian Country Communications, Mark McPherson of WAOW-TV9, Nora Hurdle of the Wausau Daily Herald. I'm Glenn Moberg. We're running out of time, and I want to get our guests to weigh in on some environmental questions that we're talking about right now. Climate change, Paul DeMaine. The Trump administration seems to be moving away from the Paris Accords and from some of the things that President Obama has done in this arena. What's your reaction to that?
Well, and the Walker administration scrubbed the words, climate change, global warming from most of its site. But it did rain on Christmas Day in northern Wisconsin. That's a fact. The maple trees did run in the January warm-up. That is a fact. So, I'm really concerned about, I think, the long-term direction of our environment. That's what really has brought out a lot in me over time. I work with Indian communities and people who are concerned about the fossil fuel industry, the quality of our water, the quality of our eatable resources in northern Wisconsin. I think it's only going to deteriorate under a Trump and Walker administration, as it has over the last six years of the Walker administration, where laws that are protecting those waters are removed. The permitting process is changed to accommodate big business. I don't see much positive coming from it.
Well, data from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration indicates that 2016 was the hottest year on record, the third in a row that that's happened. Scientists, of course, tell us that climate change is perhaps the most serious threat that we face. Our coastlines and island chains could be underwater. We're talking about the destruction of ecosystems and habitats around the world. Mass extinction, which is going on right now, according to some observers. Widespread famine, the displacement of millions of people, the loss of our fishing resources in the ocean because the coral reefs are dying off. And that seems pretty important, yet it isn't a priority with our politicians, either nationally or in Wisconsin, Nora.
Well, I think a lot of times the key to bipartisan efforts, even when it comes to energy, is workforce, is economic development. So, I mean, I think if climate change advocates can phrase this in a way that works for the economy, I mean, that we might be able to get more people to the table in terms of reporting. I said it before, and I think it's really important. I think we should keep telling those stories. As Paul said, those observations about what's going on in northern parts of Wisconsin, the rain on Christmas Day, the effects on maple trees, we should be talking about those things.
Mark?
And I think the debate right now is, and I think even most conservatives will admit that climate change is happening, it's whether we are creating that, affecting that climate change. And I think if the changes are getting us, are them saying, let's get back to a debate about whether climate change is man-made, I think that's one thing. But if it's just ending all science and all research and all investigation into what's causing this, I think that's problematic.
And we had scientists actually taking their data before the Trump administration took over and moving it to data banks in Toronto and other places in order to protect it. Mm-hmm. Whether that's paranoia or not, we can debate that, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Got time for one more question. It's got to be a quick one. What do you think the top story of 2017 is going to be when we look back at this past year? Nora, do you have any ideas?
I think the refugee crisis and the immigrant debate is the big one. It's what Donald Trump ran on.
Mark?
I think it'll be whether Donald Trump can get past the early problems he's had in his presidency and if there is going to be a change or if it's going to be the same President Trump we've seen.
And Paul DeMaine, what do you think the big story of 2017 is going to be?
For Indian Country, I'm concerned about what the story is going to be about out at the Standing Rock Reservation where the standoff continues over a pipeline. But I do think that the national story will be this immigration ban and the outcome over the course of time.
Do you think we're going to see a renewal of demonstrators out at Standing Rock? Do you think people are going to be coming back from Wisconsin and going there again, Paul?
Well, there are still people out there. There is numerous people out there, and I'm really concerned about the escalation of it. I just feel that there may be the loss of life because people on both sides are both so adamant about having it their way. So
so I'm concerned about that.
All right. Thank you all for being with us today. It's been a really informative and interesting hour, and we're going to get on out of here with a guy from Auburndale, Wisconsin, Jerry Schmidt.
There ain't no news on the jukebox. There ain't no good inside. There ain't no indication of where you are tonight. There ain't no news on the jukebox. There ain't no good advice. There ain't no information. That's why I'm blue tonight.
We want to thank today's guest, Paul DeMaine, CEO and Managing Editor of Indian Country Communications, Nora Hurdle, Public Issues Investigator for USA Today, Network Wisconsin, and the Wausau Daily Herald, and Mark McPherson, News Anchor for WAOW-TV9 in Wausau. Thanks also to Brian Jopek, News Director and Reporter for the Lakeland Times. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our Executive Producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Janice Schleiss. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by the Electric Light Orchestra. Don Henley, Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash, Hedgehoppers Anonymous, Joe Jackson, and Jerry Schmidt. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, until next week, we're heading out of town.
Joe, why don't you bring me another beer, another whiskey? Maybe we can figure out where she went. Well, what did I do this time?